A brisk, cool wind whipped the ragged uniforms of his men as they stepped onto desolate land. Arrakis, their new base of operations. It would be a long time before anyone heard of Dominic Vernius again. But when he was ready, the entire Imperium would remember. A world is supported by four things: the learning of the wise, the justice of the great, the prayers of the righteous, and the valor of the brave. But all of these are as nothing without a ruler who knows the art of ruling. Prince Raphael Corino discourses on galactic leadership. The last chapter. Leto worked his way down to the shore alone, zigzagging along the steep cliffside path and staircase to reach the old quays below the edifice of Castle Caladan. Through cloud patches, midday sunlight glimmered off the placid water that stretched to the horizon. Leto paused on the sheer black rock cliff, shading his eyes to look beyond the aqueous kelp forests, the fishing fleets with their chanting crews, and the line of reefs that sketched a hard topography onto the sprawling sea. Caladan, his world, rich in seas and jungles, arable land and natural resources. It had belonged to House Atreides for 26 generations. Now it belonged to him, uncontested. He loved this place, the smell of the air, the salt of the ocean, the tang of kelp and fish. The people here had always worked hard for their duke, and Leto tried to do his best for them as well. If he had lost his trial by forfeiture, what would have happened to the good citizens of Caladan? Would they even have noticed if these holdings had been given over to the surrogate governorship of, say, House Tyrannos, House Mutelli, or any other reputable member of the Landsrad? Perhaps. Perhaps not. Leto, though, could not imagine being anyplace else. This was where the Atreides belonged. Even if he'd been stripped of everything, he would have returned to Caladan to live out his life near the sea. Though Leto knew he was innocent, he still did not understand what had happened to the Tleilaxu ships inside the Highliner. He had no evidence to prove to anyone else that he hadn't fired the blasts that nearly triggered a major war. On the contrary, he'd certainly had sufficient motive. And because of this, the other houses had been reluctant to speak strongly in his defense, allies or not. Had they done so, they would have risked their share of the spoils if the Atreides' holdings were forfeited and divided. Yet even during that time, many houses had sent silent expressions of approval for the way Leto had protected his crew members and friends. And then, by some miracle, Emperor Shaddam had saved him. On the flight home from Kaitain, Leto had spoken at length with Thufir Hawat. But neither the young duke nor the warrior Mentat could fathom Emperor Shaddam's reason for coming to the aid of the Atreides, or why he had so feared Leto's desperate bluff. Even as a boy, Leto had known never to trust an explanation of pure altruism, no matter what Shaddam said in his moving statement before the court. This much was certain. The new emperor had something to hide, something involving the Tleilaxu. Under Leto's guidance, Hawat had dispatched Atreides spies to many worlds, hoping to uncover further information. But the emperor, forewarned by Leto's mysterious, provocative message, would no doubt be more careful than ever. In the vast spectrum of the Imperium, House Atreides was still not particularly powerful, and had no hold on the Corino family, no apparent reason to be protected. The blood ties were not in themselves enough. Though Leto himself was a cousin to Shaddam, many in the Landsrad could trace their bloodlines at least peripherally back to the Corinos, especially if one went all the way back to the days of the Great Revolt. And where did the Bene Gesserit fit in? Were they Leto's allies or his enemies? Why had they offered to help him? Who had sent the information about Shaddam's involvement in the first place? The coded message cube had disintegrated. Leto had come to expect hidden enemies, but not allies who remained so secretive. And, most enigmatic of all, who really had destroyed the Tleilaxu ships. Alone for the moment, but still troubled, Leto stepped away from the cliffs and crossed a gentle downslope along the gray-black shingle at the water's edge, until he reached the quiet docks. All the boats had been taken out for the day, save for one small beached coracle and a yacht at anchor, flying a faded pennant with the hawk crest of the Atreides. That hawk had come perilously close to extinction. In bright sunlight, Leto sat at the end of the main dock, listening to the lapping waves and the songs of gray gulls. He smelled salt and fish and the sweet, fresh air. He remembered when he and Romber had gone out together to dive for coral gems, the accidental fire and the near disaster they had suffered out on the distant reefs. A small matter in comparison with what had occurred later. Peering into the water below him, he watched a rock crab as it clung to the dock piling, then disappeared into the blue-green depths. "So, are you satisfied to be a duke, or would you rather be a simple fisherman after all?" Prince Romber's loud voice sounded bright, blustering with good cheer. Leto turned, feeling the sun-warmed dock boards beneath the seat of his trousers. Romber and Thufir Hawat trudged across the crunching shingle toward him. Leto knew the Master of Assassins would chide him for sitting with his back vulnerable to the open beach, where the white noise from the ocean might mask any stealthy approach. "Perhaps I can be both," Leto said, standing and brushing himself off. "The better to understand my people." "Understanding your people paves the way to understanding leadership," Hawat intoned, an old Atreides maxim. "I hope you were meditating upon statecraft, as we have much work to do now that all is returning to normal." Leto sighed. "Normal? I think not. Someone tried to start a war with the Tleilaxu and blame my family in the process. The Emperor fears what he thinks I know. House Vernius is still renegade, and Romber and Kylia remain exiled here, though at least they were pardoned and the blood price on their heads has been lifted. Moreover, my name was never actually cleared. A lot of people still think I attacked those ships." He scooped up a beach pebble that lay on the dock and tossed it far out on the water, where he couldn't discern the splash it made. "If this is a victory for House Atreides, Thufir, it's bittersweet at best." "Perhaps," Romber said, standing next to the beached coracle. "But better than a defeat." The old Mentat nodded, his leathery skin reflecting the harsh sun. "You handled yourself with an air of true honor and nobility, my duke, and House Atreides has gained widespread respect. That is a victory you must never discount." Leto looked up at the tall towers of Castle Caladan looming high on the cliff. His castle. His home. He thought of the ancient traditions of his great house, and how he would build on them. In his royal station, he was an axis upon which millions of lives revolved. The life of a simple fisherman might have been easier after all, and more peaceful. But not for him. He would always be Duke Leto Atreides. He had his name, his title, his friends. And life was good. "Come, young masters," Thufir Hawat said. "It's time for another lesson." In high spirits, Leto and Romber followed the Master of Assassins back up to the castle. Afterword. For more than a decade, there had been rumors that I would write another novel set in my father's Dune universe, a sequel to the sixth book in the series, Chapter House Dune. I had published a number of acclaimed science fiction novels, but wasn't sure I wanted to tackle something so immense, so daunting. After all, Dune is a magnum opus that stands as one of the most complex, multi-layered novels ever written. A modern-day version of the myth of the dragon's treasure, Dune is a tale of great sandworms guarding a precious treasure of melange, the geriatric spice. The story is a magnificent pearl with layers of luster running deep beneath its surface, all the way to its core. At the time of my father's untimely death in 1986, he was beginning to think about a novel that carried the working title Dune 7, a project he had sold to Berkeley Books. but on which there were no known notes or outlines. Dad and I had spoken in general terms about collaborating on a Dune novel one day in the future, but we'd set no date, had established no specific details or direction. It would be some time after he completed Dune 7 and other projects. In ensuing years, I thought about my late father's uncompleted series, especially after I concluded a 5-year project writing Dreamer of Dune, a biography of this complex, enigmatic man. A biography which required that I analyze the origins and themes of the Dune series. After long consideration, it seemed to me that it would be fascinating to write a book based upon the events he had described so tantalizingly in the appendix to Dune. A new novel in which I would go back 10,000 years to the time of the Butlerian Jihad, the legendary Great Revolt against thinking machines. That had been a mythical time in a mythical universe, a time when most of the great schools had been formed, including the Bene Gesserit, the Mentats, and the Swordmasters. Upon learning of my interest, prominent writers approached me with offers of collaboration. But in tossing ideas around with them, I couldn't visualize the project coming to fruition. They were excellent writers, but in combination with them, I didn't feel the necessary synergy for such a monumental task. So I kept turning to other projects, avoiding the big one. Besides, while Dad had sprinkled many provocative loose ends in the 5th and 6th books of the series, he had written an afterword for Chapter House Dune that was a marvelous dedication to my late mother, Beverly Herbert, his wife of nearly 4 decades. They had been a writing team in which she edited his work and acted as a sounding board for his overflow of ideas. So, with both of them gone, it seemed a fitting conclusion to leave the project untouched. The trouble was, a fellow named Ed Kramer kept after me. An accomplished editor and sponsor of science fiction fantasy conventions, he wanted to put together an anthology of short stories set in the Dune universe, stories by different, well-known authors. He convinced me that it would be an interesting, significant project, and we talked about co-editing it. All the details weren't finalized, since the project had a number of complexities, both legal and artistic. In the midst of this, Ed told me he had received a letter from best-selling author Kevin J. Anderson, who had been invited to contribute to the proposed anthology. He suggested what he called a shot in the dark, asking about the possibility of working at novel length, preferably on a sequel to Chapter House Dune. Kevin's enthusiasm for the Dune universe fairly jumped off the pages of his letter. Still, I delayed answering him for around a month, not certain how to respond. Despite his proven skills, I was hesitant. This was a big decision. By now I knew I wanted to be involved closely in the project, and that I needed to participate to such a degree in order to ensure the production of a novel of integrity, one that would be faithful to the original series. Along with J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings and a handful of other works, Dune stood as one of the greatest creative achievements of all time, and arguably the greatest example of science fiction world-building in the history of literature. For the sake of my father's legacy, I couldn't select the wrong person. I read everything I could get my hands on that Kevin had written, and did more checking on him. It soon became clear to me that he was a brilliant writer, and that his reputation was sterling. I decided to give him a telephone call. We hit it off immediately, both on a personal and professional level. Aside from the fact that I genuinely liked him, I felt an energy between us, a remarkable flow of ideas that would benefit the series. After obtaining the concurrence of my family, Kevin and I decided to write a prequel, but not one set in the ancient times, long before Dune. Instead, we would go to events only 30 or 40 years before the beginning of Dune, to the love story of Paul's parents, to the planetologist Pardit Kynes being dispatched to Arrakis, to the reasons for the terrible destructive enmity between House Atreides and House Harkonnen, and much more. Before writing a detailed outline, we set to work rereading all 6 Dune books my father had written, and I took it upon myself to begin assembling a massive Dune concordance. an encyclopedia of all the characters, places, and wonders of the Dune universe. Of primary concern to us, we needed to determine where Dad had been heading with the conclusion of the series. It was clear that he was building up to something momentous in Dune 7, and without intending to do so, he had left us with a mystery. There were no known notes or clues, only my memory that Dad had been using a yellow highlighter on paperback copies of Heretics of Dune and Chapter House Dune shortly before his death, books that no one could locate after he was gone. In early May 1997, when I finally met Kevin J. Anderson and his wife, the author Rebecca Moesta, new story ideas fairly exploded from our minds. In a frenzy, the three of us either scribbled them down or recorded them on tape. From these notes, scenes began to unfold. But still we wondered and debated where Dad had been going with the series. In the last two books, Heretics of Dune and Chapter House Dune, he had introduced a new threat, the reviled Unnered Maitres, who proceeded to lay waste to much of the galaxy. By the end of Chapter House, the characters had been driven into a corner, utterly beaten. And then the reader learned that the Unnered Maitres themselves were running from an even greater mysterious threat, a peril that was drawing close to the protagonists of the story, most of whom were Bene Gesserit Reverend Mothers. A scant 2 weeks after our meeting, I received a telephone call from an estate lawyer who had handled matters involving my mother and father. He informed me that two safety deposit boxes belonging to Frank Herbert had turned up in a suburb of Seattle, boxes that none of us knew existed. I made an appointment to meet with the bank authorities, and in an increasing air of excitement, the safety deposit boxes were opened. Inside were papers and old-style floppy computer disks that included comprehensive notes from an unpublished Dune 7, the long-awaited sequel to Chapter House Dune. Now Kevin and I knew for certain where Frank Herbert had been headed, and we could weave the events of our prequel into a future grand finale for the series. We turned with new enthusiasm to the task of putting together a book proposal that could be shown to publishers. That summer I had a trip to Europe scheduled, an anniversary celebration that my wife Jan and I had been planning for a long time. I took along a new laptop computer and a featherweight printer, and Kevin and I exchanged FedEx packages all summer long. By the time I returned at the end of the summer, we had a massive 141-page trilogy proposal, the largest that either of us had ever seen. My allied Dune Concordance project, the encyclopedia of all the marvelous treasures of the Dune universe, was a little over half completed, with months of intensive work remaining before it would be finished. As we waited to see if a publisher would be interested, I remembered the many writing sessions I had enjoyed with my father, and my early novels in the 1980s that had received his loving, attentive suggestions for improvement. Everything I had learned from him, and more, would be needed for this huge prequel project. Brian Herbert. I never met Frank Herbert, but I knew him well through the words he wrote. I read Dune when I was 10 years old, and reread it several times over the years. Then I read and enjoyed all of the sequels. God, Emperor of Dune, hot off the presses, was the very first hardcover novel I ever purchased. I was a freshman in college. Then I worked my way through every single one of his other novels, diligently checking off the titles on the other books by page in each new novel. The Green Brain, Hellstrom's Hive, The Santa Roga Barrier, The Eyes of Heisenberg, Destination Void, The Jesus Incident, and more and more and more. To me, Frank Herbert was the pinnacle of what science fiction could be, thought-provoking, ambitious, epic in scope, well-researched, and entertaining, all in the same book. Other science fiction novels succeed in one or more of these areas, but Dune did it all. By the time I was 5 years old, I had decided I wanted to be a writer. By the time I was 12, I knew I wanted to write books like the ones Frank Herbert wrote. Throughout college, I published a handful of short stories, then began to write my first novel, Resurrection Incorporated. a complex tale set in a future world where the dead are reanimated to serve the living. The novel was full of social commentary, religious threads, a large cast of characters, and, yes, a wheels-within-wheels plot. By this time, I had enough writing credits to join the Science Fiction Writers of America, and one of the main benefits was the membership directory. There, before my eyes, was the home address of Frank Herbert. I promised myself that I would send him the very first signed copy. The novel sold almost immediately to Signet Books, but before its publication date, Frank Herbert died. I had avidly read the last two Dune books, Heretics and Chapter House, in which Herbert had launched a vast new saga that built to a fever pitch, literally destroyed all life on the planet Arrakis, and left the human race on the brink of extinction. That's where Frank Herbert left the story upon his death. I knew that his son Brian was also a professional writer with several science fiction novels under his belt. I waited and hoped that Brian would complete a draft manuscript, or at least flesh out an outline his father had left behind. Someday soon, I hoped, faithful Dune readers would have a resolution to this cliffhanger. Meanwhile, my own writing career flourished. I was nominated for the Bram Stoker Award and the Nebula Award. Two of my thrillers were bought or optioned by major studios in Hollywood. While I continued to write original novels, I also found a great deal of success in dipping my toes into established universes, such as Star Wars and X-Files, both of which I love. I learned how to study the rules and the characters, wrap my imagination around them, and tell my own stories within the boundaries and expectations of the readers. Then, in the spring of 1996, I spent a week in Death Valley, California, which has always been one of my favorite places to write. I went hiking for an afternoon in an isolated and distant canyon, wrapped up in my plotting and dictating. After an hour or so, I discovered that I had wandered off on the wrong trail and had several extra miles to hike back to my car. During that unexpectedly long walk, out in the stark and beautiful desert scenery, my thoughts rambled over to Dune. It had been 10 years since Frank Herbert's death, and by now I had pretty much decided that Dune was always going to end on a cliffhanger. I still very much wanted to know how the story wrapped up, even if I had to make it up myself. I had never met Brian Herbert before, had no reason to expect he would even consider my suggestion. But Dune was my favorite science fiction novel of all time, and I could think of nothing I would rather work on. I decided it would do no harm to ask. We hope you have enjoyed revisiting the Dune universe through our eyes. It has been an immense honor to sift through thousands of pages of Frank Herbert's original notes, so that we might recreate some of the vivid realms that sprang from his research, his imagination, and his life. I still find Dune as exciting and thought-provoking as I did when I first encountered it many years ago. Kevin J. Anderson. A requirement of creativity is that it contributes to change. Creativity keeps the creator alive. Frank Herbert, Unpublished Notes. This concludes the reading of Dune, House Atreides, by Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson. This book was read by Michael Pritchard. Additional titles in the Dune series in the Books on Tape library include Dune, Dune Messiah, and Children of Dune. For more information about them, or for help with topics of related interest, please call our customer service department or check our catalog index to find review material. If you have enjoyed these tapes, you may want to consider buying this audiobook and donating it to your local library so that others in your community can enjoy it too. The donation will be deductible to the extent allowable under the law. Books on Tape produces many new unabridged audiobook titles each month. To find out more about them, or to arrange a library donation, or to speed your next title to you without delay, call our customer service department.